Good evening, all of you beautiful beings of energy and light. Thank you for joining us under the influence of tonight's moon that is waxing in the earth sign of Taurus as we come together to explore, to connect, to learn, to grow, to be inspired, to heal, and raise consciousness together. Taurus's influence through the moon, whose energy governs our emotions, reminds us that this is a great time to listen to our bodies and to give them some love. I'm your host, Jessica Dillon Winter, and I pay homage to you for tuning in. I'm coming to you live from the Dive-In in downtown Lake Worth, Florida, and my guest this evening is Leanna Patch, also known as the English Maven. She's calling in from New Orleans, Louisiana. Leanna is an insanely creative and free-thinking writer, editor, and copy blogger certified content marketer. She's a born and raised New Orleanian whose bold approach to writing and life breathes fresh air into the spaces she invades. Some of her ongoing projects include writing and editing for New Orleans Living Magazine and the Philly Art Blog. Leanna studied English and creative writing at Tulane University in New Orleans. She currently runs a successful freelance writing, editing, and marketing business called The English Maven. I'm going to speak with Leanna this evening about a number of topics, including her inspirational sources, tips on overcoming writer's block, our time spent together at a Buddhist monastery in New York where we met, her latest blog article, How to Build a Better Bookshelf, and much more. Leanna, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jess. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, how's New Orleans?
New Orleans, let me tell you, was great this weekend because it was about 70 degrees, and now it's back to being cold again, and no one knows what's going on, but that's kind of how it works here. I don't know. Is Florida like that?
Yeah, very much so. Actually, that reminds me, I saw this thing floating around Facebook that said something about Florida winter, and it was like, yay, I survived Florida winter, and it was like February, 19th through 20th or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so well, it's warm here.
I don't know, I feel like a lot of people get sick. Oh, sorry, go on.
No worries. No, I think our weather's pretty much the same. So, Leanna, you and I met each other at a Buddhist monastery in upstate New York just this past year, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you hadn't really delved too much into Buddhism before you got to the monastery, right? You just kind of found your way there through John, your friend?
Yeah, that's right. I have been friends with John since high school, and he often had a lot of trouble with paying attention, he was kind of a hyperactive kid, and he tried out different medications, and he found some that worked for him and some that didn't make him feel great, and then I'm not sure when he started exploring Buddhism and mindfulness, but I think it was when he got to college or somewhere in his college experience, because he went to about three schools. But I remember noticing this change in him where he just seemed so much calmer and more present and happier with himself. And so I was like, I want some of that for myself. and I had also been introduced to mindfulness through my my therapist. So I was coming at it from a couple different places, but I still didn't really know very much about Buddhism, and especially Tibetan Buddhism.
So you mentioned mindfulness a couple of times. And is that something, mm-hmm. a topic that you studied or tried to practice a lot before you found yourself at the monastery?
A little bit. I think I was first introduced to it through that therapist I mentioned, who was trying to help me find ways to deal with generalized anxiety and depression. So I at first was averse to the idea of taking any medications, and I thought maybe there's a cognitive approach I can take. And so, you know, mindfulness does have its roots in a lot of Buddhist practices, so I kind of came to it like that.
Okay, that's interesting. I think a lot of people actually come to it the same way. Of course, we all are on our individual journeys, but that is a story with a lot of people who I speak with. How do you feel as a writer that mindfulness helps you with your writing?
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword because, you know, in addition to being a writer, I'm an editor, and, you know, you're told not to edit as you write because it just kind of keeps you from establishing a flow. But I definitely do a lot of that, especially when I'm on a deadline for this magazine that I work with 2 days a week. I find myself constantly trying to create the sentence exactly as it should be the first time around. And it's, you know, in that case, it's become a bit of a quicker process. But I think that that's kind of where mindfulness works against me. And I think it would be better for me if I can try to establish a pattern of, you know, I'm aware of the fact that this sentence may not be the best it can be right now, but I also want to keep going and then I'll come back to it later. So kind of using mindfulness in a different way than I am right now.
And that's something I personally can relate to quite a bit because, as you know, I myself am also a writer and an editor, and it's you know, you don't always have someone who is both. You know, you might have someone who's a writer and then they have an editor, or you have someone who's an editor but not a writer. And I think those of us who have both skill sets and a knack for both really have that internal struggle. Just you just explained it, you know, I mean, your mind is, you know, as you're going through and trying to be creative and trying to let things flow, you have that more logical or left brain side that's really trying to just, you know, make it more perfect or more succinct as you're letting the flow come. Is that your same experience as mine?
Yeah, no, that's a good description of it. They're definitely two different processes. And so, yeah, it's kind of like, you know, that I don't know if you've heard of this brain surgery phenomenon when they cut the corpus callosum in between the two hemispheres of a person's brain, which sometimes they have to do for severe epilepsy. You'll have the hands doing two opposing actions at once. So one hand will be buttoning up the shirt and the other hand will be unbuttoning it. So it kind of feels like that when you're writing and you're also editing.
That's interesting. I actually hadn't heard of that, but that's a very great description of the crazy process
kind of
going inside, going on inside. Yeah, for sure. So what inspired you to become a writer in the first place?
It's kind of funny. It was actually just because my dad suggested it offhandedly. I had planned my whole life to be an artist, and so eventually I refined that into wanting to be a comic book artist, and I drew a lot of comics in high school, and I started college at Tulane as a studio art major and a music minor, because I was like, you know, this would be a great way to make a living. I'm just kidding. and I took, you know, I took a couple studio art classes, and I had a teacher who just really didn't inspire me, and I felt really frustrated, and I looked around and I saw, you know, that I was not the worst person in the class, the worst artist in the class, but there were a lot of people there with this very innate talent, and I was feeling pretty discouraged, and I was like, maybe I should find something else to do, because I could work, you know, I had the option of working really hard and, you know, making my skills better, but I was thinking I just wanted to leave the art department. And so I mentioned this to my dad, and I think it was over Christmas break, and he said, oh, well, I always thought you'd be a writer. I was like, okay, I'll do that. So I just switched my major to English and went from there.
That's interesting. You know, you and I, you know, our backgrounds are very similar. You know, I paint, and I'm a singer, you know, and I have this whole writing and editing thing. So, you know, creativity comes in so many different forms or so many mediums that are used to express creativity. Mm-hmm. And you're right. You know, I mean, some people, they just, you know, they have that one medium that they channel all of their creative energy through, and they just do absolutely brilliant things. And I think, you know, not to compare struggles, because we all have, you know, experienced suffering, will experience suffering at different levels and different times of our lives. But somehow I just feel like, I don't know, sometimes I feel like I'm totally insane, you know, with like trying to take this energy, this creative wild energy, and channel it. It's like, what do I do? You know, do I paint? Do I write? Do I do this? Do I do that? Do you struggle with a lot of that still?
I think so. I don't draw as much as I used to, but I know what you mean, where it's like you want to do something, but you're not quite sure what it should be. I sometimes sew. I'll make, you know, little projects out of T-shirts here and there. But I think it's become writing for me. But I also, you know, I find myself stifling those more creative impulses sometimes just out of laziness, because if I've written for clients all day, then the last thing I want to do probably is keep writing later on. But that's another area of improvement for me.
And I know that, you know, as I mentioned in introducing you, you know, you're an extremely creative and very bold writer. Your writing is very raw, it's very real. You use very colorful language, you know, very real talk in your writing. But I know that you also have clients, you know, for whom you can't necessarily write in those ways. So how do you deal with, you know, trying to, let's say, write for, you know, the magazine, when it might not necessarily match your natural writing style? What interesting writing quirks do you have?
I would say for the magazine, I interview so many people, and I feature a lot of people, because we, you know, that's primarily our focus, is the people of New Orleans. And so I try to let people's own voices speak for them. So I basically see my writing for that magazine as shaping, you know, forming a framework for their quotes after I've interviewed them. And then in my own blog, I definitely get to be more myself. And you hear so many, you know, content marketing schools and well-known people in the field say that, you know, to really be successful, you have to be your authentic self, because people want to work with you. They don't want to work with a facade. So I think that by allowing myself to be more open and honest, and, you know, even I didn't even used to post anything political on Twitter, just in case potential clients saw it and were turned off. But now, you know, I know that I want to attract people who appreciate that, or who appreciate those qualities, and, you know, they'll value me more because they know who I am.
That's a very good point. You know, that's being true to yourself. And I went through that same process also, you know, where I would try to hide certain parts of me because I was afraid, you know, of what other people might think, or losing, you know, potential clients, even friends sometimes. But, you know, through all of my study, you know, Buddhist study and meditation practice and introspection and just moving through life experience, really learn to overcome that, you know, and accept and love myself for who I am, and understand that there's so much power and potential and peace in coming to that place within yourself that you can just be centered and accept fully who you are. And it's not even necessarily that, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, don't care what other people think. It's not that you don't have to care what other people think. It's just more, I think, about really, truly accepting yourself.
And you're just naturally going to attract people who want to work with you after that, you know, or at least, you know, not work with you, but be your friends or be in touch with you.
That's true. And I found myself, too, just in the same place you did, where it was like, well, you know, I want to attract people who appreciate who I am, you know, not people who, you know, might be turned off by who I truly am.
Right.
But I think that all goes
then you're constantly having to I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I can say you're constantly having to sort of prove yourself, and then you're proving yourself as someone who you aren't even. Mm-hmm. You know, you're constantly filling someone's expectations of you.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that all goes back to, you know, ego, which is something that everyone who knows me knows I talk a lot about, because it was one of the greatest things, I think, that was really driven into me through my Buddhist study. We were constantly receiving these teachings on how to cut through the ego. And I think I may have even mentioned this on the last show, but, you know, a lot of people don't realize we have negative and positive ego. You know, we have the positive ego that is that voice in your head that says, you know, you're better than the person next to you. And then the negative ego that mm-hmm. says, you know, you're a piece of shit and you can't do this or that. And so it's a constant struggle we all have to try and find the middle ground, the balance between those two poles within us.
Mm-hmm.
Have you struggled with that yourself?
I have to ask, because I definitely do. I want to ask, I'm not familiar with that part of Buddhist philosophy. Is that middle ground? Is that the lack of ego? Is that what you're striving for? Or is that what you're, you know, asked to strive for in Buddhism?
You recognize, it's a recognition that the ego is there, the ego exists, and mm-hmm. that you are taught that your mind is more powerful, that you, your higher self, is above the ego. And so mm-hmm. you're taught to be mindful. Again, it goes back to awareness and mindfulness. Be aware mm-hmm. of when, you know, certain thoughts that you have or certain reactions that you want to have to something someone says or a situation, where those are coming from in you. Is it that positive ego? Mm-hmm. Is it that negative ego? And then ultimately, it really all just breaks down to compassion and practices of what in Tibetan Buddhism, at least, which is the lineage I studied, is called a bodhisattva, and mm-hmm. that's basically one who is, you know, constantly doing good deeds. And, you know, through
right.
my own personal transformation, you know, 2014 was an extremely transformational year for me. And when I got through the end of that and had gotten to a certain place where I did all of this introspection and grew so much and expanded my consciousness so much, I realized really, you know, my purpose here in this body form, you know, and this lifetime is just to try and help others see the light within themselves and to love themselves and to spread love and peace and happiness. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of my mission that I've undertaken. And even just, you know, like with the radio show, it's around the same time that the radio show came, because I had a lot of people who were coming to me on a one-on-one basis and asking me for advice mm-hmm. and whatnot, as they were struggling through certain things, and people still do. But I'm an empath, so I also very much pick up the energies of the people who I'm around. And it's difficult for me, it's draining for me to work one-on-one with people. And so the radio show opportunity presented itself, and it was a perfect opportunity to be able to reach a much larger group of people without having
yeah.
that personal drain. So, yeah, that I don't know if that answers your question. It's kind of a very verbose answer.
No, it did. It did. And I think to get back, I think to what your original question was, which is, you know, whether I deal with the negative and positive ego thing, I would have to say all the time, every day. And it's definitely something that, you know, I was not aware of until it was pointed out to me. And it was pointed out to me by the same therapist who I just started seeing again. And she's a cognitive behavioral therapist. So she works with the ways of thinking that we unconsciously fall into and addressing those. And so when I first started seeing her, she pointed out that, you know, my negative ego was constantly comparing me to other people and making really unpleasant observations about other people, and I really couldn't stand criticism. And of course, I didn't want to hear any of that, so I chalked it up to her being unhelpful. but recently, you know, the other day, we were getting back into some of the ways that I've been thinking, and she said, you know, it really seems like you're listening to your thoughts more. So when I do have those ungracious, let's call them, thoughts about other people or, you know, drivers behind me on the street, I am able to hopefully look at them and say, like, well, you know, it's not personal, and maybe just give it a rest, and, you know, they might be having a bad day, who cares, things like that. So
exactly.
It's a constant battle.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, and I, by no means, with all of the work that I've done and with the place I feel I've sort of arrived at, I definitely don't feel like it's an arrival. You know, it's a constant process, but it's that constant process of awareness. And as long as I think you, if you can get to that place where you are aware and you're constantly reevaluating yourself to make sure that you can be the best version of yourself, that's really where I think you can find the most value. And you and I talked a little bit about that, you know, being the best version of yourself. So what are some of the things you're doing right now in that realm?
Well, right now it's a little bit more aspirational because I just overbooked myself way too much these past few weeks, and I know you understand that. But that's part of it, you know. Being the best version of yourself involves taking the time that you need and setting a limit on your schedule for what you can do for other people. You know, for example, I didn't have time to go grocery shopping for the past couple weeks, and so I was scrounging the cabinets and eating processed food and doing things that I knew weren't going to make me feel good or perform well mentally, but I just had given away too much of my time. So I think I'm still really trying to find the balance between, you know, a work schedule for me that feels fulfilling but not overbooked, and, you know, then actually getting to the yoga studio or the gym or out for a run, you know, and making sure that I do things that are good for me physically and mentally.
And it's interesting, you know, when I open the show, I always talk about the current phase of the moon, because it has such, the moon's energy has such an effect on us, whether we realize it or not. And I mentioned how the moon is currently moving through the sign of Taurus, and we should be focusing more at this time on our physical selves and giving ourselves, our bodies, a little more attention and love. So you just mentioned some things that you're doing on that level with eating and exercising to try and be that better version of yourself.
Yeah, well, right now that's still in the embryonic stages in my mind. I have a bad track record of my past track record of going to Bikram yoga, which is my personal favorite, not everyone's favorite, but I like it a lot. I'll go for about 6 months regularly, and I'll be like, oh, well, I fixed everything that's wrong. Okay, I'm done. And then I quit for about 6 months and get sick and start feeling horrible, and then I go back and the cycle repeats. So now that I've acknowledged that, I'm working on maybe going more regularly and not lapsing for so long in between classes. But it's definitely a challenge.
It is, you know, and at the same time, too, I think it's important for us to not always put so much expectation on ourselves, though, either, you know, not beat yourself up if you aren't able to make it to that yoga class when you said you were going to go.
Well, it's, yeah, it's the balance between knowing what's good for you and motivating yourself to do it, and also not being overbearing, you know. But I've never erred on the side of overbearing when it came to exercise. I know that about myself. I've always erred on the side of laziness.
So let's bring it back to the writing just a little bit, because I want to talk about what are some of your creative, inspirational sources for your writing?
Well, I don't write too many short stories anymore, but I did. That is what I majored in, and that's my first love. And I love sci-fi. And William Gibson is one of my favorite writers, not just sci-fi mm-hmm. writers, but writers in general. And he has a short story collection called Burning Chrome that always, you know, I've reread it so many times, and it's just the ease with which he creates these completely different worlds and makes them seem so natural and then tells really human stories within them mm-hmm. never fails to inspire me. So I read that, and then I, you know, try not to compare myself with him, but it's a good source of inspiration.
That's great. That's awesome. I used to always force myself, I think because I have this, you know, very intellectual side of me, I used to always force myself into reading, you know, all of this nonfiction, and mm-hmm. I used to struggle so much to get through it. And then I would pick up a piece of fiction, and I would just float through it and get lost in these books, and it would just be awesome and liberating. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I had that other side of my mind that was like, wait a minute, come back here, you know, and it would force me back into the nonfiction. So, again, you know, with these struggles, you know, going back and forth constantly. It's great when you can find really great pieces of fiction, and I very much enjoy the same type of fiction as well, as well as very mythological type of stuff. Actually, the Myths of Avalon. Not sure if you're familiar with that by Marion Zimmer Bradley. It's probably my favorite.
Familiar.
Yeah, it's the story of the Arthurian legends, but told through the eyes of all of the women in the story, and kind of emphasizing their.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it's kind of a, dare I say, feminist, you know, spin to it. So it's good. And
I definitely think there's a men. Oh, sorry. Go on.
No. Go ahead, please.
I was going to say, I think there, you know, there's absolutely a mental time and place for nonfiction, and you know, for me, it's marketing books. Where you do feel like you just kind of want to dig into something, you know, historical or self-improvement heavy. But I know that the easiest thing for me is always going to be.
Mm-hmm. And you're a copy blogger certified content marketer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. Copy blogger is one of the, I would say, best known resources for copywriting and content marketing. But if you, you know, are not familiar with those areas, then you will never have heard of them. mm-hmm. Anyone in the field has heard of them, and everyone outside of them, you know, has never heard of Copyblogger. But they're great. And so they kind of built the whole giving away free content to get people's loyalty model, which so many businesses and brands use now.
Right.
So they have an education program, continuing education called Authority. Mm-hmm. And so that's a yearly subscription model, and it gets you, you know, ebooks and webinars and all sorts of things that have been hugely helpful for me. And so, you know, the first time they offered the certification, I think I was actually in the first class of people to apply for it. And it was an 8-week certification class on top of the Authority program. So it was only open to Authority education people. Long story short, it was a great class. It was, you know, it was a little time intensive, but the worksheets were, you know, all geared toward improving your business. And so at the end of it, you take a certification test. And then you are placed on a list of certified content marketers. And I would say that, you know, along with the education part of Copyblogger, being on that list has been really great for me too, because, you know, I get to piggyback on the loyalty and trust that they've built, which is so much bigger than what my business has.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been really rewarding.
That's awesome. And I mentioned also when I was introducing you, you write for New Orleans Living Magazine. You do a column for them, right? Or you write for them a couple of times a week or something along those lines?
I work on contract with them 2 days a week, and so in that time, I write about half the content in the magazine each month. So I do a lot of features. As I mentioned, we focus a lot on people, so I do an arts column. I do something called the Live Well Mind and Body column, which is where we highlight local businesses or restaurants or people that are, you know, either they're green or they're helping people get healthy. You know, it's all about health and wellness in that section. And then we spotlight three locals every month who are just doing something interesting. It can be all sorts of stuff. I talked to a Girl Scout executive board member, a travel photographer, and the executive chairman of the Jewish Community Center for this month's upcoming issue. So it's a huge range of people.
Okay, that's awesome. I was just going to ask, you know, if you could tell us about some of the interesting people that you've, you know, interviewed for some of your latest articles. Do you want to talk a little bit more about any of them?
Sure. Well, you know, I feel really lucky that I get to talk to so many people because New Orleans is an incredibly diverse place, and it attracts, you know, all sorts of people, but it definitely attracts people who love adventure. And so last month when I was talking to this guy, he told me he's from outside of Chicago, and he started as a music therapist. And then he started as a music therapist for underprivileged kids. And so he took a bunch of them on this sort of outward bound type trip, and he took a camera and he got into photography, and that was sort of his trigger for his next phase of his career. And now he's a travel photographer who has been evacuated from Everest, and he's hiked and mountaineered and sea kayaked and climbed glaciers all over the world, taking these crazy pictures. And, you know, I got to chat with him for 45 minutes about what that was like.
That sounds really awesome. I bet he has some great stories.
Yeah, I said, do you have any openings at your company? I'm scared of heights, but I've got spunk.
That's cool. And you also write for the Philly Art Blog in addition to your own personal blog. So tell me a little bit about the Philly Art Blog.
Yeah, well, the Philly Art Blog is based in Philadelphia, surprise, surprise. And it's been around for so long. I think it's been around for 13 years, if I'm not mistaken. And it's a huge source of art reviews and interviews and podcasts. So basically arts coverage from theater and, you know, visual arts to music and lectures. So I am the editor, and I work with, we have about, I would say, 15 to 20 writers who regularly write for us. So I work with them on their coverage of both local and national and international shows, so that we can grow appreciation of the arts.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Philadelphia is a very cultural city also, you know, just like New Orleans, of course, they have very different flavors. As you know, I lived in Washington, D.C. for about 5 years myself, and so Philadelphia is not too far away. I used to make trips up there on the weekends sometimes just to go exploring. Have you visited the city before?
I have. Actually, it's strange because after Katrina, so I was a junior in high school when Katrina hit, and we evacuated to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and then eventually to Philly. And the publisher of the art blog is one of my parents' longtime friends. And so we stayed with her after Katrina, you know, when I was in high school, figuring out what I was going to do next. And so I ended up going to boarding school just outside of Philly. And I got to take the train into the city on the weekends sometimes. So I've spent a little time, but I feel like I was a senior before I really figured out how cool Philadelphia was. And by that time, I was about to graduate. So I wish I had spent more time there.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. When you visit a place as a child, and, you know, you have you go back later and you have a different appreciation for it, or you realize that you know you would like to go back because you might have a different appreciation. That's kind of like with me. I first visited Washington, D.C. when I was 12, on my safety patrol trip. And I remember, you know, being this 12-year-old little girl running around this big, huge city, being from, you know, South Florida, and thinking like, whoa, this is friggin' amazing, and I'm going to live here one day. And, yeah. You know, I did. it was one of those things I just kind of always had in the back of my mind that I was going to accomplish. It was like one of those big, great, you know, milestone checkbox that I wanted for my life. And I'm very grateful mm-hmm. to have had the opportunity to live in a city that's filled with so much culture and history and so many different interesting people. I don't know if I would ever live there again, but I'm so grateful for the opportunity to have been able to live there. Now I want to go back as a tourist, though.
mm-hmm.
Because, of course, when I lived there, you know, I looked at it very differently. I was, you know, living and working there, working very much many, many long, long hours at a crazy, hectic job, and you know, driving or walking past, you know, the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial every day, but never really stopping mm-hmm. to go in and appreciate them. And when I had visitors who would come in and visit me, I was, you know, busy playing tour guide and making sure they had an awesome experience. So I wasn't really fully taking in and enjoying everything myself.
yeah.
So it's interesting. And so what about when you're doing the writing portion of your work and you, which I assume you do because I think most writers do, run into writer's block. You just, you know, don't have anything really coming to you. How do you overcome that? Do you have any tips for people who might be listening who are interested in writing or who are writers and want to learn how to best overcome that struggle?
Yeah. I think more of what I experienced I would call procrastination block, where it's not that I don't have anything to write, it's just that I can think of 1,000 things that I should probably do first. And when that happens, I go to the coffee shop, which is just a few blocks away from my house. And it's sort of this implied accountability where if I am on my laptop at the coffee shop, then I am working because I can't be on social media and I can't be reading some article on some site because if I'm here, then I must be working. So that's my sort of fail-safe strategy. But I think sometimes, you know, unless you're under deadline, it's okay to have writer's block. You know, you don't have to get something on the page every single time. And I think a lot of writers vary in their schools of thought with this. I had a professor in college who said that he got up and wrote every single day at 7 a.m. and he's a successful poet, and that was how he did it, was just having the discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a balance, and you have to find a personal balance for yourself, you know. If you're going to sit down and write and nothing is coming, but you've been sitting down and writing for, you know, every day at the same time for weeks, then cut yourself a break, do something else, give your brain a break, and then come back.
I think that's a great piece of advice, and I've heard the same from a lot of writers. They have that very scheduled time that they put into it, and I myself am a little more, you know, in the air with it. And do you do that yourself? Do you have that scheduled writing time? I mean, I know you're writing and editing all day, but do you use a process like that where you very deliberately sit down with yourself at a certain time to do a certain type of writing?
I do, yeah. And my calendar lately has been a slave driver because I know that I'm supposed to be working on this project at this time. And so sometimes I can cheat a little bit. If I sit down to write, say, a package of Facebook posts, which I have been doing a lot lately, and they're just not coming, I'll look a little bit later in the day and see if there's something else that looks more appealing and start there. I'll start with editing a post that's going up on the Philly Art blog because I can always edit more easily than I can write. You know, it's easier to look at someone else's words before starting to create your own. So that's kind of like the warm up. And then, you know, I've been working for 30 minutes. And you're kind of already in it. And I read a lot of productivity blogs lately that say, you know, if you don't want to do something and you really don't want to do it, start for 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just tell yourself you're going to do it for 2 minutes. And then after 2 minutes, chances are you're already doing it. You know, you're not going to
right.
stop.
Right. Yeah. So you mentioned earlier your latest blog article, which was How to Build a Better Bookshelf. And I included a picture mm-hmm. of your beautiful little bookshelf in the slideshow that our listeners should be able to see right now if they're online with us.
Awesome.
And so tell me about that. I loved your blog article. I thought it was awesome. Tell me about some of the things on your bookshelf and just can you kind of, yeah, just tell me about it. Leanna, are you there? You're breaking up.
Oh, okay. There you are. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, yes. Go ahead.
Okay, perfect. I think I missed that part of your question, actually. You said on your book. And...
Leanna, are you still with me?
Oh, yeah.
I think we're having some atmospheric interference. Leanna? I think we've lost Leanna, so I'm going to try to get her back. Bear with us just a moment while we work through these technical difficulties.
my bookshelf.
That's right.
What
I was. I hope everyone can hear you. I've got you. I finally have Leanna back. I was able to get her on my cell phone, and I have her on speakerphone. I'm holding up my cell phone to the microphone for the show. So, yes, we were talking about your bookshelf, Leanna. Please go ahead, continue it, and hopefully this will work and listeners can hear you. And if not,
yeah,
I'll be sure to let them know where they can find you, which I'll just go ahead and say now is theenglishmaven.com. TheEnglishMaven.com. But go ahead, please. Tell us about your bookshelf.
Sure. Well, I realized that I sort of unconsciously go to stand in front of my bookshelf when I'm feeling like I don't know what to do, in very much the same way that I find myself standing in front of the fridge, even when I'm not hungry. And so I was trying to figure out what it was about, you know, this area of my house that I unconsciously gravitate to, and I realized that I had, because of space constraints, organized my bookshelf into just a collection of the things that I love the most. There's really nothing there that I don't love. You know, there are definitely books that challenge me and that I don't feel as connected to, but I appreciate their craft, and that's why they're on the shelf. So, I wrote a blog about it, kind of distilling how I got to this place, and I think I divided my shelf into fiction I love, fiction I haven't gotten to yet, business and grammar nerd stuff, and of course, because I do a lot of editing, I have style guides and marketing books, things like that, and then creative shit, which is the bottom shelf. Just a lot of comic books and creating a graphic novel for dummies, which I was trying to do in high school. So there's something there for no matter what I'm feeling, and that's kind of why I end up there.
And you've got some whiskey on that shelf too, don't you?
Oh yes, a lot of whiskey. As you can see in the pictures on the blog, there's a few different kinds of Jameson. I was lucky enough to visit the Jameson Distillery in Dublin a couple years ago.
Oh, cool.
I'm still holding on to like two precious sips of the Distillery Reserve, which you can only buy there, and I don't know why I didn't buy more. Probably just too expensive, but they're these sad ones. So.
That's awesome. So, Leanna, what do you like to do when you're not writing and editing, when you're not working?
What do I like to do? I try to get outside because I spend so much time at a desk or on a couch at the coffee shop. So I like to take walks around my neighborhood, especially when, you know, dusk is coming and there's this really beautiful light. And this is going to sound so morbid, but it's not, I promise. I go to a cemetery near my house. So in New Orleans, we have above ground cemeteries because the water table is too high to hear people below ground. So they're just these very beautiful, peaceful places, and I kind of take a mindful walk around the cemetery. But when I'm not working in graveyard, I also like to sing, just like you, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I just started singing backup in a friend's band. We've had one rehearsal, so we'll see how that goes.
That's awesome.
And what else do I do?
What kind of music are you guys doing in the band?
She writes. She's an incredible songwriter, and she writes and arranges blues and sort of gospel tunes. And she plays piano and sings, and I'm doing backup vocals. And she's got a trumpet player, a trombonist, and an upright bass player and a drummer. So it's a full band, and it's a very sort of, very, you know, you wouldn't expect it from her. It's very blues-oriented because she's a very quiet person, but she just lets loose on these sort of like, well, I had it, now I don't kind of songs. But it's a lot of fun.
That's great. And I bet with the horns, too, that adds a really fun element to it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We have so many fabulous horn players in New Orleans, and so she found two of the best. We're lucky to be playing with them.
Yeah, that's great. Lots of fun,
I'm
sure.
Oh, and I also do improv. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, please, go ahead.
I do stand-up comedy and improv.
That's awesome. That's one thing I did not know about you at all.
Funny, you know, it's kind of like the same thing when people ask me what I did this weekend, my mind goes blank. If you ask me what my hobbies are, I feel like a really boring person, but I know I do a lot of stuff. So I actually have improv after this show, and I, every now and then, I don't do it as much as I used to, but I'll go do a stand-up comedy open mic. So I did one of those on Sunday, and it went really well. I think I might do it again tomorrow.
That's really cool.
There's just a huge number of opportunities in New Orleans to do comedy.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
It's crazy.
Yeah. So is that, do you do that, like, weekly, or?
It's a lot like the exercise thing, where I'll do it for a period of time and then kind of get sick of it and stop. I average probably once every 3 weeks. I'll go up to a mic, and then some months I'll go to 3 mics in a week, and then nothing the next 2 weeks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it really depends. It's a very social thing, and sometimes I just kind of feel like staying in and catching up on the dishes like a boring person.
That's okay. Sometimes it's okay to be boring. Again, you know, it's
yeah,
finding that balance. And there have been a few times through our conversation that really that element of forgiveness and forgiving yourself and being not so hard on yourself has come to mind. And I know I think I just mentioned it like once, but there were a couple other times when you said things that it came to mind. And so I don't know. Maybe that's the ultimate topic of our show tonight.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I think it's self-talk.
Yeah.
You know, paying attention to how you speak to yourself and making sure that you're not saying anything that you didn't say to your closest friends.
And what can you tell me about life hacks?
Oh, okay. So I think I thought of this topic because I heard you say something about your calendar, but I am obsessed with automating as much of my work as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so one app that I constantly recommend, if you use Gmail, it's called Boomerang.
Boomerang?
Boomerang. And so it will, you can schedule messages with it to go out whenever you want. You can set reminders for certain messages to come back to your inbox whenever you want. What else does it do? It's just basically it makes sure that you never forget to follow up, which is invaluable, you know. I'm trying to keep a lot of balls in the air, and there's a lot of deadlines happening, and they're not all my deadlines. And so instead of making 1,000 calendar events, I just schedule a message to Boomerang and then know that it's going to come back. But I love this sort of techie, you know, inter-app connections that you can make.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to take advantage of as many of those as I can. I could go on. I don't know if this is boring.
No, go ahead. Any of this, it's not boring at all. I think it's very useful. Any kind of useful tips, tools, you know, we can provide to people to help them, you know, run their lives a little bit better and be a little happier is good. So go on if you have more.
Okay. Well, there's also a site, and some people have probably heard of this, but it's called If This, Then That.
If This, Then That.
Mm-hmm. I think it's ISPPT.com.
Okay.
And it's just a very simple system where you can set one quote-unquote channel to trigger something. So, for instance, you can say, whenever I post a photo to Instagram, save that photo to Dropbox automatically. Or whenever I text a certain number and I hashtag that text, eCal, it will add the event to your Gmail calendar. So they call them recipes, and you can set up all sorts of crazy recipes. People have figured out how to wrangle this so that they don't have to search for apartments. It's not a direct step with this, but it's something you can set up where it will email you all the Craigslist postings for apartments that match their criteria. So you don't even have to look for them. things like that.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So it sounds like you've found a lot of technological tools to kind of help, you know, with the flow of your life to make things a little bit more organized and maybe give yourself a little bit of a break here or there.
Yeah, and there's one actually, I might have mentioned this to you before, but I think your listeners will also appreciate this one, especially if they work on a computer. It's called Awareness, and it's a free, I'm not sure if it's for both Mac and PC, but it definitely works on Mac. And it's this lovely little Tibetan singing bowl that sits in your system tray, and you can set it to ring once an hour, which is its default setting, or for longer periods of time. And it will ring a simple bell sound when you've been working for an hour with no break.
That is an interesting segue to, I actually, just as you began to mention that, I picked up my wooden block for my singing bowl because I have it sitting here next to me. And
nice.
at the end of the show, I bring us through as well as I can, a sort of a little bit of a guided meditation. We're running out of time. But we'll go ahead and we'll close here. And I'd like to just read a page very quickly from Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Buddhist master from Vietnam, from his book, How to Love. So I'll bring us into that. And I always just randomly choose whatever the passage is and hope that it'll resonate with the people who are listening. So now we have, non-discrimination. It says, in true love, there's no more separation or discrimination. His happiness is your happiness. Your suffering is his suffering. You can no longer say that's your problem. In true love, both happiness and suffering are no longer individual matters. You are him and he is you. In a good relationship, we are like two fingers of the same hand. The little finger doesn't suffer from an inferiority complex and say, I'm so small, I wish I were as big as the thumb. The thumb doesn't have a superiority complex, saying, I'm more important, I'm the big brother of all the fingers, you have to obey me. Instead, there's a perfect collaboration between them. That very much reminds me of what we were talking about earlier with the balance, you know, finding that middle way between the negative and positive ego.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, Leanna, thank you so much for being with me this evening. I greatly appreciate your time. I hope you have awesome fun at your stand-up comedy show here in a few minutes after this.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
You're very welcome. And again, listeners, you can find Leanna at theenglishmaven.com. Thank you for being in the stream, and I hope you'll join us next week when we speak with my close friend and accomplished meditator, Dalian Chase. That's next Tuesday at 7 p.m. on In the Stream. Good night, all you beautiful people.